Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 1, Enforcement Trends and Issues. Ivan Harris and Mary Jo Gillette will discuss current and important enforcement trends and issues in the hedge fund industry. Now, on to the podcast.
So last year, just to recap where the SEC landed on the last year of the Obama administration and the last year of Mary Jo White's tenure as chair of the SEC, the SEC brought 868 enforcement cases, which was another record year. And they tend to pride themselves year after year on bringing a record number of cases. And last year represented a 7.5% increase from their fiscal year ending 2015. Not all of the SEC's cases are new ones that count towards that number. And so a couple of years ago, in response to criticism that they tend to sometimes inflate their numbers, they started breaking out new enforcement actions. And of the 868, 545 were counted as independent actions, new ones. And the remaining were follow-on administrative proceedings or delinquent filing cases that tend to clog up their annual count. The money that the SEC collected was somewhat down, but still a steady clip, a little over $4 billion in penalties and disgorgement, but that represented a 2.6% decline from the prior year. What was a significant decline was only 6 cases were tried in federal court. The trial docket last year was much smaller than it had been in recent years. Those of you who have attended this conference in the past and have followed SEC enforcement efforts and developments, there's been a trend over the last couple of years after Dodd-Frank for the SEC to take many more cases to their administrative tribunal as opposed to federal court. And there's been significant criticism of that in the industry and in Congress for that practice, or some parts of Congress. And so perhaps in response to that, the SEC moved fewer cases through its administrative proceedings last year. And so even those cases were down. So less litigation last year than in prior years, perhaps also reflecting a more cautious approach to bringing cases in the last year of Mary Jo White's tenure, and fewer borderline cases, which are the ones that more commonly go to trial. In the IA space and in the BD space, which are always the two heaviest components of where the SEC brings its enforcement actions, the trend was steady. And in particular for investment advisor and investment company cases, which is the purple line that you can see, they remained about 18% of the SEC's cases. And when you combine it with the broker-dealer cases that the SEC brought last year, it's slightly less than 40%, but again, a trend that's consistent. And so SEC registrants remain the largest component of their enforcement program, and a natural outgrowth of the fact that SEC registrants are the ones that are also examined on a periodic basis and result in many referrals of examinations to enforcement. And we'd expect that trend to continue as we get into some developments from 2016 and what we expect to see going forward in 2017. Mary Jo?
So to add to what Ivan just said on the statistics of the breakout of the cases, these categories that you see listed are not something that we independently looked at and broke into. This is the way the SEC reports where they have expended their enforcement resources in their annual report to Congress. So they are the ones that define the categories. As Ivan pointed out, almost 40% of their resources resulted in cases brought against regulated entities. But if you look carefully at the other categories, you can see that, and how they choose where to count a case is very difficult to tell from the public standpoint. So for example, insider trading cases, some of those are not going to involve regulated entities, but many of them do. Market manipulation cases also involve regulated entities, since those tend to be the vehicles through which the market is manipulated by others. And so I think that to say that 40% of the enforcement resources were spent on regulated entity cases is probably a low number. This is a trend that really began to increase in the wake of the financial crisis, when Rob Kazami became the director of the Division of Enforcement, and he made a conscious decision at that time to redirect enforcement resources away from, not entirely, but substantially away from public company financial fraud and accounting fraud reporting type cases towards the industry. And that was partially a recognition of the fact, or belief, I guess, by many, including him, that it was really in large part conduct that had occurred in the securities industry that had fed into and had a systemic impact that resulted in the financial crisis. There is a renewed effort on the public company financial fraud, auditor fraud front at the SEC, and we're seeing more resources allocated there, and we will see more in the upcoming years, but they have not at all reduced the focus or the deployment of resources in the regulated space. I want to talk a little bit about their use of big data. For those of you who've been here in past years and heard me speak before, this has been an increasing trend under Mary Shapiro. She created first something called an Office of Risk Fin, which eventually became a new division at the SEC, the Division of Economic and Risk Analysis. And that is staffed by economists, which they've long had. One of the new areas that they really have moved into is increasingly hiring quants to also staff that office, and not only academics, but quants who have previously worked in the industry for some of the larger players in the securities industry. And they have exponentially increased their capabilities in terms of analytics around data. It's part of a larger and more longer term initiative that they have, in which they fully intend, or at least it's their goal, to build out a database that over time, once it has adequate data in it, will allow them not only to do some of the things they're doing now, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but also eventually to be able to do predictive trending, which I'm sure most people in this room know what that is. Interestingly, in the last year, so DERA, the Division of Economic and Risk Analysis, supports all of the divisions and all of the work of the SEC. They work with the Division of Enforcement to identify conduct and firms that may be engaging in that conduct through data first to zero in on firms that may have a higher than likely chance that they are engaging in the conduct that's being examined. They use it to inform examination priorities, examination initiatives and sweeps. They use DERA, the agency uses DERA to inform and provide reports to the commissioners, both on proposed rule changes once they're proposed, but also to identify areas where perhaps there needs to be either modification of or the promulgation of new rules in certain areas. The interesting thing is that in the last year, both the Division of Enforcement and OC, which is the examination program, have also now stood up their own embedded group. Enforcement calls it the Center for Risk and Quantitative Analytics, which they have announced participated in more than 75 matters, including enforcement actions against 67 entities, as the slide says. And OC has created a new office called the Office of Risk and Strategy. Each of these offices that are embedded within examination and enforcement also serve as liaisons and work very closely with DERA to think about designing data analytics and hypotheses that they can then test first through data to begin to inform them around both program and policy initiatives. I'm not going to say much about insider trading. There's a whole panel later in the day that is going to go into this in a lot more detail, except to say that despite Newman and Salmon, the SEC has continued to be very aggressive in this area and in the last year charged 78 parties with insider trading. We wanted to touch just briefly on some of the changes that we have seen and expect to continue to see in 2017. So I will talk first a little bit about staffing. Of course, as we all know, there is a new chair of the SEC, Jay Clayton. He has only been in the seat for a few short weeks. And then in addition, there are two other commissioners in place who were there previously, Commissioner Pivovar, who is the Republican, and Commissioner Stein, who is the Democrat. There are two vacant seats on the commission, and they continue to remain vacant. And that is only important from the standpoint of understanding what it takes for the SEC to approve and take action on anything, enforcement or otherwise, rulemaking, et cetera. There are very few tasks that the commissioners delegate to the staff. Almost everything goes up for a vote by the commission. So when you have three commissioners sitting in total, which is what we've got right now, you need two votes to get something approved. And currently we have two Republicans and one Democrat sitting at the chair level. In terms of new SEC senior staff, the new chief of staff is Lucas Moskowitz. General counsel, new again, Robert Stebbins. The director of the Division of Corporation Finance recently announced William Hinman. And very recently, most recently, Chair Clayton has decided to appoint co-directors of the Division of Enforcement. This is the second time this has happened in the history of the SEC. Mary Jo White did the same thing when she initially came in. And so he has appointed Stephanie Avakian, who has been serving as the acting director of the division since Andrew Chereznyi left at the end of December, and Steve Pekin, also from Sullivan and Cromwell. Other things to keep your eyes on, earlier this year, President Trump signed an executive order on regulatory principles. Because the SEC is an independent agency, it is not technically bound by executive orders, but historically it has chosen to voluntarily follow them. And this is, among other things, the mechanism by which you've probably heard in the press, if not otherwise read it, in which the White House has pronounced that for every new regulation, they have to retire two. There are some other provisions to it as well, but that may have impact going forward. In terms of developments in the investment advisory and investment company regulatory area, things to keep your eyes on are the changes and proposals regarding custody, the new liquidity rule, and reporting modernization. And finally, in terms of potential legislative changes, the CHOICE Act 2.0 is now being considered. It would, if enacted, repeal or modify several of the key provisions in Dodd-Frank. And the impact it would have would reform some of the SEC's approaches in the enforcement and rulemaking areas. So another thing to sort of keep our eyes on.
And from the enforcement perspective, a couple of somewhat conflicting signals, although some of these preceded Jay Clayton becoming the SEC chair. So we had earlier this year the somewhat or limited rollback of the delegated formal order authority, which for those of you who may not know, a few years ago, to help speed up investigations, the commission delegated to most of their senior officers in enforcement the ability to issue formal orders of investigation, which give the SEC staff the ability to issue subpoenas in the course of investigations and to compel testimony from witnesses. Acting Commissioner Pewar rolled that back a little bit to limit the ability to issue formal orders to only the Director of Enforcement, and that rollback continues to this day. On the other hand, the appointment of Stephanie and Steve as the co-directors of enforcement certainly signals, you know, two people with significant enforcement backgrounds, Steve, the former head of the Securities and Commodities Fraud Task Force of the Southern District of New York, before going into private practice, signals an apparent interest in maintaining a strong and aggressive enforcement program. So a couple of conflicting signals, but on balance, given who they have heading up the enforcement program, most likely an intention to continue an aggressive.
Well, and I think along those lines, just to add a footnote, and then we're going to move on to some cases. Before Jay Clayton arrived, so Commissioner Pivor was the acting chair of the agency, and in addition to pulling back the delegated authority on formal orders, he began and asked each division at the SEC to undertake a self-assessment addressing a number of things, including what delegated powers they had and how they were using them, how they were deploying resources, what their priorities were, et cetera, to make a report back to him. In terms of what's been disclosed publicly, it doesn't appear that he made, before Chair Clayton arrived, any additional changes internally based on the results of that, but the information has been gathered, and so I would guess, whether he'll do anything with it or not, that at a minimum, Clayton will take a look at that and make his own assessment. cases. So the first case is Backstreet Capital Management. This case was brought by the commission just about a year ago. First of all, it was an examination referral, so it started an exam. They referred it over to enforcement. Backstreet was a registered PE fund advisor, and the case named both the firm and also their principal, Murray Gunty. The specifics of the case were that it was a settled case, so there's a settled order that makes factual findings. And the order found that the firm had engaged in unregistered broker activity. What does that mean? It means that they were engaged in fee-based transactions, transactional fees beyond your advisory fees, which that, together with all of the other things around what they were doing, met the definition of a broker-dealer, which requires that you be registered. They were not registered, and so they were charged under Section 15A1 of the Securities Exchange Act for their unregistered broker activities. There were also several other issues that were captured by the case. They were charged with charging partner oversight fees to two portfolio companies when the fees were neither authorized nor disclosed. They were charged with unauthorized use of fund assets, specifically using them to make political and charitable contributions and to pay certain entertainment expenses. The fund principal was found to have improperly acquired interests in Backstreet advised private equity funds from limited partners, so unauthorized purchase of a portfolio assets or interests. The settlement, which again, both the firm and its principal were named, brought a cease and desist order against both the firm and the individual. The firm was also censured, and they were required to pay jointly and severally a disgorgement in a little over $2.3 million plus prejudgment interest on top of that, and a civil penalty in the amount of $500,000. The order did acknowledge that there were several proactive remedial steps that the firm had taken before the settlement was entered into, and that was factored into the settlement. And some of those included voluntary retention of compliance consultant, ceasing their practice of charging the partnership oversight fees entirely, revising their policies and procedures because they were also charged under Rule 20647, which is the compliance rule for really abject compliance failures, and then returning all of the limited partnership interests, the portfolio company interests, and the money to the funds. So I think from that and the fact that it was written into the order, we can assume that the monetary penalties might have been even higher than this had they not taken those proactive remedial steps.
And it's interesting because one of the few SEC cases involving, as Mary Jo was talking about, just a secondary transaction. So although the fund governing documents had said that the funds would have the first right to repurchase the LP interests, the general partner, the advisor, wound up purchasing those interests without first offering them to the funds. One of the few secondary type cases you'll see out there, and one of the remedial efforts they undertook was to have the advisor and the GP forfeit those interests and return them to the funds in advance of the case. So a couple of brief points on the insider trading cases, which again, most of these will be covered later on today, but wanted to mention the Cooperman and Artis cases. For those of you, I'm sure many of you followed the Cooperman case, on paper it looked like the perfect SEC enforcement case. Someone with undoubted access to company insiders who had purchased in the funds numerous out-of-the-money call options with short duration in a short time period before a significant company announcement, significant profits, and Mr. Cooperman took the fifth in his SEC testimony. So on paper, seems like a perfect insider trading case. The one problem was that the SEC could not allege with specificity when Mr. Cooperman had agreed to keep confidential the information he had learned from the company insider in whose stock the funds had traded. So the SEC had alleged over a number of days leading up to this major announcement, Mr. Cooperman had spoken with the company CEO. And at some point during those discussions, the CEO had asked Mr. Cooperman to keep the information confidential. But that discussion, that request, may have occurred after the material non-public information had already been passed to him. And that became the subject of Cooperman's motion to dismiss, that under insider trading law, the obligation or the promise to keep the information confidential must take place either before or at the same time that the confidential information is passed. The court rejected that defense in ruling against Mr. Cooperman in the motion to dismiss, so setting some new law in that area. This was the first case that considered that issue. And so the court held that the promise to keep the information confidential can occur after the information is already passed, and that the breach, the violation, occurs at the time of the trade, not when the promise is made. So that's the significant issue that comes out of Cooperman. One significant issue that comes out of his settlement is that he was allowed to remain in the business. Most likely in light of that litigation risk, the settlement allowed him to continue acting as an advisor and did not bar him from the industry, when in practice, the SEC, whether you make $5 on insider trading or $50 million on insider trading, their general practice is to bar you for life from participating in the industry, and he did not suffer that consequence. Artis is an important one, and one that we discuss periodically every couple of years. The SEC brings a 204 Cap A case, which is the rule that requires advisors to have policies and procedures regarding the potential misuse of material non-public information. Artis had essentially hired as one of their analysts someone out of an expert network firm who had many contacts with the industry and worked from home and not in Artis's main office. And as a result of that person's contacts, he came into possession of material non-public information, passed it along to his supervisory analyst, who then caused the firm to make trades that were very profitable based on the information that the employee had obtained. Both Artis and the individual, the supervisory analyst, were charged for failing to adopt and enforce policies and procedures that were specifically tailored to the risk that that particular employee presented. So worth a read, because every couple of years the SEC brings one of these cases that focuses on inadequate policies and procedures that aren't sufficiently tailored enough to address the particular risks that an employee or a situation may present to the misuse of material non-public information. And then finally, Platinum Management presented a panoply of violations that we see every once in a while in SEC hedge fund cases. The ones that I just wanted to focus on really briefly, because we're out of time, are the allegations regarding valuation, which is something that does pop up in particular when there are significant holdings in a particular security that make up the fund's portfolio. In this instance, the fund had interest in two companies that constituted majority interest in those companies, wound up acquiring additional interest in those companies at a value significantly lower than what was calculated for purposes of the fund's NAV. So the SEC is always going to be looking at other transactions that might give an indication of actual value and that might conflict with how a fund is valuing an asset for purposes of NAV, and that certainly occurred there. And then one of the other interesting things about Platinum Management is we saw the SEC dig kind of deep down into the org chart and charge an employee in the investor relations department who, during the process of trying to discourage investors from going through with redemptions or talking to investors about potentially delaying redemptions until a subsequent quarter as the fund was deep into a liquidity crisis, did not disclose to those investors the liquidity problems that the fund was experiencing. So not only in Platinum Management did the SEC charge the principals, but they also reached down into investor relations, which has a very difficult job in those circumstances, and emphasized the need for those employees, when they know of certain issues and they're talking to investors about similar issues, to disclose relevant information and material information in the course of those conversations. Thanks very much.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.